Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Coutillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased to have with us Professor Mark Cornwall. Professor Cornwall is Professor of Modern European History at Southampton University. He has written, co-authored, and or co-edited, edited a good number of books dealing with Central European history in the late 19th, early 20th century. And today we are discussing his latest edited book, Sarajevo 1914, Sparking the First World War, published by Bloomsbury Academic. Welcome, Professor Cornwall.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be with you.
Professor, what are the origins of this particular book that you've edited?
Well, this book came out of a conference we held in 2014 in England, and that conference was very much trying to think about the anniversary of the outbreak of the war in 2014 and to look at the origins of the First World War in a new way, I suppose. We were mainly trying to get some new angle on the war. And my own interest in the subject is I'm particularly interested in the Habsburg Empire. And my research has been on that for many years. And also, I've always been very much interested in the Yugoslav question and the creation of Yugoslavia. So that helped me to focus my thoughts on producing a conference and then a book which would be thinking about the origins of the war, particularly in the Balkans or in Southeast Europe, really.
In your introduction in the book, title The Southern Slav Question, I noticed that you omitted two perhaps important facts. The first one was that in the early 1880s, then Obrenović, King of Serbia, offered to sell the kingdom to Vienna, something that Vienna refused. And the second one was that up to a year prior to the annexation crisis of 1908-1909, Vienna was relatively relaxed about its position in the Balkans because as per a prior agreement with Russia in 1897, both powers had agreed to put the Balkans on ice, in quotation marks. Why the omittance of these two facts?
Oh, you mean I omit those two facts? I think there was a amount I could say. I was mainly trying in that introduction to introduce the Southern Slav question as a problem. I think the fact that, yes, certainly Serbia was a client state of the Habsburg Empire in the 1880s and the 1890s, and that gave the Habsburg Empire some security, feeling that this problem had not completely being put to bed, but that it was under some control. But from the 1890s, I would say that becomes more problematic. I mean, the last Obrenović king, Alexander, certainly started to drift away from the Habsburg orbit in the 1890s, and relations between Austria, and this isn't usually said, but relations between Austria and Serbia certainly seem to be getting a bit worse from Austria's point of view, or the Habsburg Empire's point of view, in the late 1890s. You're right that, yes, there was a special entente concluded between the Habsburg Empire and Russia in 1897, and that kept the peace to some degree in the Balkans. Kept this problem on ice for perhaps about 10 years. But I think it's always there under the surface. And the problem was being on ice meant that the Habsburg Empire didn't, or the Habsburg elite did not particularly look for solutions to this empire during that period, I think. It's sometimes said that, you know, while Russia was away fighting Japan in the Far East, while Russia had all its problems with 1905, some historians say, you know, Austria-Hungary should just have gone in and crushed Serbia at that point and dealt with this problem once and for all. So I think it's the Southern Slav question, as I call it, because that's the kind of a key theme of the book. I think this is a problem which is, it's always there in some form. And I think the problem always for the Habsburg authorities is, how will they deal with this? Will they just try to ignore it? Will they go in and try to use force to deal with it? Will they try to use compromise to deal with it? I think all those methods are contemplated or tried at some point. It's a bit of a mixture, and the danger is that events will get out of their control because they haven't taken the initiative, I suppose.
Would it be not the case that one of the results of the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s was to undermine the teleological reading of the Southern Slav question of pre-1914, that in essence the 1918 solution, in quotation marks, was not in fact inevitable?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think it is inevitable. And of course, nowadays, Serb, Croatian, Slovene historians will certainly not be suggesting that there's an inevitability about creating Yugoslavia. I think, yes, part of the problem before 1914 or before 1918 is this notion, this fear in Habsburg minds, in the feeling of the Habsburg government, that some kind of Yugoslav solution was inevitable, and that they must try to deal with this fast before it came about. And also, certainly, it's what motivates many nationalists in the region itself, down in the south of the Europe. It certainly motivates nationalists in the region thinking that there's an inevitability. But yes, I mean, I would certainly not say that there's an inevitability about this. And I think the book shows, actually, that the essays in the book show rather well the variety of contexts and the kind of fluidity in society, the fluidity in politics, that there were many, many solutions possible to come out of this South Slav problem. It just happens that this Yugoslav state came out, but that it could only really happen that after a cataclysmic war, and that's what happened 1914 to 18, of course. So I think it's one of the strengths of the book, essentially, that it does show the complexity of this region and the various solutions, or there was no inevitability that there would have to be a Yugoslav state, certainly. Yeah.
In the Hanning essay in the book titled Franz Ferdinand, Power and Image, what explains the Stefan Zweig negative memories of Franz Ferdinand? Why did Zweig's image have such purchase with so many historians subsequently?
The negative image. Franz Ferdinand, I think that chapter is by Alma Hanig, who's written a good biography of Franz Ferdinand, a German historian. She's written a good biography for Franz Ferdinand, but she shows rather well the degree to which Franz Ferdinand didn't go out of his way to make friends. And although not that much was known about him, there were a lot of rumors circulating about him as a I think one C.A. McCartney, the historian, said he was a deeply unpleasant man or a deeply nasty man. So there were a lot of rumors circulating that this was a somebody with very strong prejudices, rather a bigot, hated Italians, hated Hungarians, hated Serbs, had very strong views on many issues, was deeply Catholic as well. So I think there was enough there to build up a very negative picture about him. And although the other side of him is as a family man and as a somebody who cared for his family and his children very much, and you know, we might see some other sides to him, I think there was enough there which was deeply negative, which was the reputation that survived his assassination. Now, having said that, of course, after his assassination, there were there was a real opportunity, perhaps, there after his assassination, to build up more of a positive image about him as a kind of as a victim, obviously, as a martyr or something like that. But I think, I mean, part of the trouble with this is that obviously the Habsburg Empire disappears after 1918, and so there's a lot more opportunity then to interpret these figures in a very negative way by the people, by the states that come after the Habsburg Empire. So if I think from, you know, Stefan Zweig's point of view, he would have picked up a lot of the negative rumors about, as far as I know, he never met Franz Ferdinand, but he would have picked up a lot of the negative rumors about Franz Ferdinand in Austrian society. And in Austrian society, I don't think he was any more loved than elsewhere in other parts of the empire. So, yeah, he's a deeply, I would say he's quite an enigmatic figure, Franz Ferdinand, because of the fact that he was not very prone to, he was not very known in society publicly, but enough of his views seemed to kind of seep out to suggest that if he had come to the throne, he would have tried to impose himself quite demonstratively and reassert Habsburg power. I think that's what was feared by many peoples around the empire. Although some peoples around the empire also thought of him as somebody who might be able to do something for them. So he brings up hopes and fears in politicians around the empire. Yeah. So that's my kind of answer to that. I think he's, he's deeply, he's an interesting figure to investigate. And I think that chapter in the book tries to do that. Yeah.
How powerful was Franz Ferdinand's so-called second government in the Belvedere Palace in the years prior to 1914?
I think that becomes quite influential. He set up his own what was called the workshop in the Belvedere Palace, and it was almost like an alternative government to Franz Joseph's regime, the emperor's regime. But I think, it's influential in that Franz Ferdinand did manage to put influence some key appointments. He manages to put Conrad into the position of chief of the general staff. He manages to put certain ministers in place. So he is gradually building up a network of contacts. In the Austrian half of the empire, certainly, and also, as the book shows, also he has some influential contacts down in the south among Catholic politicians down in Croatia. He never, of course, gets much influence in Hungary because he's so anti-Hungarian. But I think also he manages to establish influence because Franz Josef realizes, you know, this is the heir apparent. He gives him more power. He makes him Inspector General of the Armed Forces. And of course, that's the role he is playing when he goes down to Bosnia in 1914 and gets assassinated in Sarajevo. So I think, he himself certainly feels that he should have more influence and that does not have enough influence. So he is constantly pushing for that. But I think he manages to achieve it to a certain degree. And I think historians have generally looked into this and concluded that he's a figure of some influence certainly by 1913, 1914, that he can bring about the rise and fall of various ministers. He actually, you know, he would probably have removed Conrad, the chief of the general staff, if he had lived on, I suppose. Yeah.
Did he approve of the temporary removal of Conrad in 1911?
As far as I know, no. As far as I know, I think not, actually. And I think that because it's temporary and then Conrad is brought back in. So as far as I know, no. But I think, I mean, he certainly, another person I haven't mentioned is the foreign minister, Aerenthal, who was also a Franz Ferdinand appointment, but again, typically falls out with Franz Ferdinand. By the time of Aerenthal's death in 1912, he's certainly fallen out with Franz Ferdinand. But Franz Ferdinand is a person who has considerable, I would say, growing power. But it's all kind of hypothetical about, you know, what he might have done if he had actually become emperor. But there are a lot of fears, particularly, let's say, by Hungarians and some other groups in the empire, that he would have tried to rule autocratically and would certainly have tried to cut down Hungary to size, I suppose.
Why did he have so little influence with the parliamentary parties?
That's an interesting question. I think... he doesn't believe that much in Parliament, for start, I think. He has some influence with... there's a Christian Social Party in Vienna, run by Karl Lueger. He has some influence there because of its Catholic ideology. But I think really Franz Ferdinand, he's more interested, rather like Franz Josef the Emperor, he's more interested in military affairs and ministerial affairs, foreign policy, that type of thing. I mean, it's a bit like asking Franz Josef wasn't that interested in Parliament either, really. So I think for Franz Ferdinand, the key thing is having influence over military and foreign policy, military affairs and foreign policy. He's certainly interested in church appointments and the Catholic Church. And takes an interest in the South Slav question to some degree. He's deeply anti-Serb, and as the book shows, he does try to he does have his own possible solution for the South Slav question in the South, of how it might be solved. But it's probably going to be solved, in his view, through force, I think.
How serious and in what fashion was Franz Ferdinand's interest in trialism?
Yeah, well, that's a controversial issue, this issue of trialism, which is about the creating of a third element in the state to go alongside Austria and Hungary. The book, I think, suggests that it analyzes what trialism meant for Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and suggests that for him it was a way towards a centralized Habsburg state. And most historians, and the book deals with this a little bit, about how to the degree to which Franz Ferdinand had perhaps rejected the idea of trialism by 1912, 1913. But certainly there was enough interest for Franz Ferdinand in this to make some politicians in the South, particularly Croat politicians or Slovenes, to make them think that he might do something for them. So a lot of this is rumours, and I think a lot of one might go into the degree to the reasons why Franz Ferdinand was assassinated, but some of it was certainly to do with the interest he had shown in this South Slav question or the Yugoslav question in the South, and the fears of some individuals that he was going to block some Yugoslav solution or not. Yeah. So it's a bit difficult to say how. We don't have a lot of information. We don't have a lot of evidence about his real interest in trialism. There are one or two, I think, memoranda about this, which were drawn up for him, which suggest he had some interest in this territorial unit. But by about 1913, I think he's largely rejecting this idea.
In the Rotten essay, Great Expectations, the Habsburg heir apparent and the Southern Slavs, the author seems to believe that the adoption of trialism would have averted the decline of the monarchy's great power position in the Balkans after the two Balkan Wars. Why? What's the rationale of that?
Sorry, I didn't quite get that. What was the question?
The question was, why did Rotten, why does he believe that the adoption of trialism would have averted the monarchy's, the decline of the monarchy's great power position in the Balkans in the period up to June 1914?
By adopting trialism? Well, because I think it would have, I mean, Rotten, he has his particular view on this, but I think because the sense would be very much that if the empire, I mean, we come back to this point about how should the empire solve the South Slav problem. Either it's going to do it by some forceful solution, or it's going to do it, perhaps a destructive solution, or it's going to do it with a constructive solution. And I think that the constructive solution would be you take the empire takes this into its own hands. It creates a trialist element in the south of the empire, and that hypothetically that would have created more stability in the south, and it would have perhaps it would have solved this problem once and for all. We might say it would have united Bosnia, Croatia, and some of the Dalmatia and some of those other South Slav lands into one unit. It would have shut Serbia out once and for all. It's all very hypothetical and idealistic, really, because it would have required Hungary to have agreed to this, and Hungary almost certainly would never have agreed to this. So one could say in theory that this would have been excellent for the empire, but I think it's pretty idealistic, really.
What seems very noticeable in the book is that some of the authors, but not all, follow the recent trend in scholarship. I'm thinking particular of Pieter Jonsson, which argues that the monarchy was not fated to collapse and that it was not in a state of crisis circa 1914. On the eve of the Great War. Why do you think that some, but not all, of the contributors of this essay collection adheres to the new scholarship as opposed to the old?
Well, I don't see a division between the old and the new, actually. I think the book is coming at this from many different angles. We've got seven historians from seven different countries here. There, some of them are looking at this question from point of view, let's say, international relations and diplomatic history, in which case they will tend to believe that those historians, and I'm thinking of people like Lothar Herbert, Thomas Otte, Roy Bridge, they will tend to think that the international position of the empire was pretty dire by 1914, and therefore it was pushed into it was quite ready to have a conflict because of that with Serbia. Perhaps some of the chapters which are thinking about this from a more social point of view, social history point of view, will incline to the Pieter Jonsson view. I don't take the Pieter Jonsson view as the absolute ideal of new scholarship, because I think the reality, you know, and I think that's a great book by Pieter Jonsson, but it is not very good on the whole issue about the position of the empire as an empire. You could easily say that, yes, this empire is, for people who lived in it, it was quite a pleasant place to be in the years before 1914. It wasn't absolutely full of social tensions. But you have to then look at why would a war break out in 1914? And I would say, basically, I mean, just to take one example, Croatia. We have two chapters about Croatia in this book. And my own chapter about Croatia very much, I think, reinforces the idea that politics is very fluid in Croatia, but also emphasizes the fact that this was not an ideal, what would be called a Reichstag. It wasn't an ideal rule of law going on in Croatia, nor was it the case in Bosnia as well. So I think I'm very much do not agree with some recent historians who suggested that, or tried to suggest that the Habsburg Empire was some kind of model Reichstag, that there was a kind of rule of law, and that tensions were declining. I don't think Peter Judson is actually suggesting that tensions are declining. He would say basically this is a an empire which is trying to cope with modernity, perhaps is coming through this. And, you know, I myself would not say that this empire is doomed in any way. But I think there are deep-seated problems in the Habsburg Empire in terms of politics, the political setup, social tensions, which is not really managing to overcome. And one has to kind of consider those quite carefully as to why this empire then breaks up at the end of the First World War. I certainly don't subscribe to the idea that this empire breaks up simply because of the First World War. I think there are deep-seated problems here from before the war, which are never really solved. So, yeah, so to go back to your question, I think it's a little bit perhaps inevitable that some historians will approach this looking more for the tensions in society, and some will be more aware of the actual position of the Habsburg Empire in international relations. And those chapters in the book certainly will be more negative about the position of the empire. If we then look a bit more closely, say, at Bosnia and Croatia, or domestic politics, then perhaps to some degree life was going on. There were tensions, but life was going on, and might have been able to adjust, but for the First World War.
You don't believe that the Heine Grunert, sorry if I mispronounce it, essay is perhaps the most teleological in nature in the book?
I think that particular chapter is that chapter, it's about the position of the Serb citizens in Bosnia-Herzegovina and how they're treated by the Habsburg state. I think that's, I wouldn't say it was teleological. I would say it's basically trying to understand why Serb citizens in Bosnia were slowly alienated from the Habsburg state. And I think he's basically trying to show that this didn't just happen in the First World War, that there was already an alienation before the war. And I try to do that also in my chapter to a certain degree, or it's what I believe, that in Croatia there's already a lot of alienation from this empire by certain educated parts of society, particularly perhaps lawyers, and many of the politicians are lawyers, so they have a very clear view about that the rule of law is not working in Croatia. So I think some of these chapters fit together rather nicely in that way, in showing that there are sections of society, or perhaps that's a little bit too strong, perhaps some influential individuals in society would be a better way to do it, who believe that, or they're slightly worried about the course of this, the way this empire is going, and some of them are already alienated before 1914, and therefore, when the First World War breaks out, of course, some of these people flee abroad because they feel this empire is, they don't want, they want to work for its collapse, I suppose.
Reading the essay by Professor Ott, one notices that he omits or belittles 2 points made by David Stevenson in his book, Armaments and the Coming of War in Europe. Those points being that, one, there was a great power race, arms race, started by Russia, that by 1914 the Central Powers were on the verge of losing it, and second, the consequences following from this fact. Why do you think that Professor Ott omits these 2 points?
Sorry, what was the second point?
The consequences falling from the fact that the diplomatic, strategic, etc., from the fact that the Central Powers were on the verge of losing this arms race?
Yeah, I can't really say. I think, I mean, his that chapter by Professor Otte is particularly trying to think about management, kind of crisis management in July 1914. And certainly there is a, I think that, I mean, there are certain unspoken assumptions, perhaps also possibly in that chapter, that one of the assumptions I think underlying, which he, as you say, may not have brought out, was the fact that it's better for the Central Powers to have a war now in July 1914, August 1914, rather than later when Russia will be even stronger. I think he does say that, doesn't he, in that chapter? I can't remember exactly.
He brings it up tangentially, but not in the context of what David Stevenson sort of talks about in terms of the arms race.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Now, in the Danilo Saronic, again, I apologize for the mispronunciation, if any, essay on Serb intelligence, would it be correct to say that he does not take the view of Christopher Clark and others that Serbia was, prior to 1914, or up to June 1914, acting in the role of, for lack of a better expression, a rogue state?
Well, I think Danilo Saronac's actually, he's a younger Serb historian, and very much, I think he appreciates the fact that attention should be drawn to Serbia's role in the causes of the First World War. And Christopher Clark also very much drew the attention of that and drew the ire of many Serb nationalist historians, I suppose, by focusing on that. I think Danilo Saronac's, in fact, in the chapter, he does say that he very much questions this idea that we should call Clark had called Serbia a rogue state. I think he is more concerned in that chapter to show the problems of the political military crisis hitting Serbia in 1914, and to show that the rogue element, I think there's a rogue element in Serbia, and it's really the rogue element is that of certain military elements in the state, paramilitary elements in that state. I think that's a better way to think about it. Whereas I think probably the politicians are less to be indicted, essentially. So I think the problem is that Clark's general sweeping comment that this is a rogue state is a bit too sweeping, really, that this is a state who, you know, Serbia was trying to play a role, let's say a kind of normal role in international relations to some degree, but was very much being knocked off course by this underlying tension in society between politics and the military. And I think Saronac brings that out rather nicely. I mean, his focus in that chapter is very much to think about well, to challenge the idea that Serbian military intelligence was in some way not very culpable, didn't have really very much of a role. And as a result, we would say that Serbia really didn't have much of a role in the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. But I think he shows rather clearly that the Black Hand, even if that organization was not directly involved in directing the plot to assassinate Franz Ferdinand, actually had quite a crucial indirect role of supplying arms to the assassins. Yeah. So it's an interesting chapter because I think it brings out the kind of the destabilizing element of Serbia in the Balkans. And I think that's a reality, and that has to be thought about by historians. It's very complicated, but I think that chapter sets it out rather clearly for the reader.
In Professor Bridges' elegant and wonderful essay, would you agree that he seems to ignore the alienation that had taken place between Vienna and London in the years prior to 1914, that the old alliance ties, which were active up to the mid to late 1890s, were by 1914, at least in London's perspective, ancient history, and that a lot of the policymakers in London, people like Nicholson and Crowe in particular, regarded Vienna as more or less Berlin's cat's paw, and therefore tended to, for the most part, ignore Austro-Hungarian concerns about the conditions in the Balkans.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I would dream of contradicting what Professor Bridge says in that chapter, because he is the real expert. You know, he spent almost a lifetime writing about this subject. I think he's fully aware of the different dimensions of this, and he looks at this in that particular chapter. He's looking at things very much through the eyes, isn't he, of the Austrian ambassador and the Austrian ambassador's links to the royal family. It's possible, yes, that in the Foreign Office there was a rather different point of view. But I think yes, he's suggesting there that the British Foreign Office essentially was not openly hostile. Or, as you say, it may be the case more that the British Foreign Office focus had been much more on Germany than on Austria-Hungary in recent years, and that is a reality. That's a kind of possible extra context he could have put in there. But I think it's an interesting, as you say, it's an eloquently written chapter, and he's trying very much to put over the fact that when the elite in Britain did look at the Austrian Anglo-Austrian relations, they established essentially that they were very cordial, and that they had not fundamentally deteriorated. I think there is a whole issue, as you say, about whether in the kind of the wider context the relations had were not particularly important for Britain in a way that they had been back in the 19th century. Yeah.
Why did the book? I'm not sure about the conference in 1914, but why did the book not have an essay dealing with Magyar concerns, subject matters, etc.?
Well, that's a useful thing to ask about, and I tried to address a little bit of that in my chapter about Croatia. But I agree. I mean, there are some angles that I would have liked to have covered in this book. I think one is certainly, as you say, one is certainly the Hungarian point of view a bit more directly. And I did try to get a chapter on that, but it didn't come to fruition in the end. Another one was, you know, in retrospect, we had a very good paper at the conference in 2014 by Dominic Leven about Russia. And I think I would have quite liked, you know, in retrospect, it would have been nice to have a chapter on the Russian point of view, particularly the Russian view of the South Slav question and its interaction there in the Balkans. That would have been a really good addition, actually. So there are a number of elements where a number of themes which it would have been nice to bring out a bit more. I think in the introduction to this book, I do actually mention the Russian point of view, because I was a bit aware that it would have been nice to have covered that a bit more. Overall,
if you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
What would it be? I think my key theme is to reassert the South Slav question or the Southern Slav question as an important factor in causing the First World War, because I think, you know, Christopher Clark did this a little bit by refocusing our attention on the Balkans as a key area which caused the First World War. But so often historians looking at the period up to the First World War or into the war also, they focus so much on the Germany's role, Britain's role, sometimes Russia, of course. Habsburg Empire tends to get neglected, as usual, very much. And yet the Habsburg Empire was really there at the core at the real center, I think, of the causes of the First World War. And so the book is trying to reassert the, you know, through the personality of Franz Ferdinand, or through the event of Sarajevo, the horrendous event of Sarajevo, 1914, it's trying to reassert the position of the Habsburg Empire in the Balkans in the course of the First World War. That's rather a long answer, but I hope that roughly summarizes what I think.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Cornwall, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Cornwall.
Thank you very much.